So to do with, you know, the nature of the universe, that kind of stuff. So now we're moving on to another argument. I was going to try to attempt two types of arguments tonight, but it's just too big. So I left one out, and we'll have to do that some other time, perhaps next year. So I'm omitting the moral argument at the moment and concentrating on the teleological argument. The word sounds large. It may be unfamiliar to many, but in a moment we'll just explain what that means. So we'll really be looking at the idea of, you know, we live in a natural world. We see evidence that appears of things functioning for a purpose, perhaps even evidence of design. And we might ask ourselves, how come? Why is it like that? And there are a variety of answers, and we'll try to highlight some of those. So if we begin with this next slide, which we'll get going in just a moment, you'll see again a rather convoluted expression come up on the screen. And this convoluted expression, here we go. Oh, there we go. Is the cumulative case inference to the best explanation. It's a form of abductive reasoning. Now, all that means is this. You get a whole bunch of things together, no one of which is sufficient to prove the point. But if you put them all together, you accumulate them, you may well have a series of cases that together need an explanation. And the best explanation may well be that there is an intelligent agent behind all these things. It's rather like getting a whole bunch of buckets, all of which have holes but in slightly different places, and you put them inside one another, and if you pour water in it, as long as the one bucket blocks the hole of another bucket and so on and so forth, the water won't come out. This isn't quite as tight as that, but it gives you an idea that you can put cases together and sort of mount one upon the other and eventually have an inference to what might be the best explanation. And I will argue, of course, that the best explanation is that there is an intelligent agent behind all things that exist in the natural world, and that intelligent agent we call God. The Bible makes it clear when it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge." Some of you might remember way back in 1995, not that far back, is it really, for most of us? But 1995, a guy named Paul Davies won the Templeton Prize, which is a prize for contribution to religion and religious knowledge. He's a physicist and a cosmologist, and I have a little clip of him speaking about some of the sorts of things that he thinks about the nature of the universe.
Part of the motivation for introducing the multiverse explanation for the biological fine-tuning of the universe was to finally get rid of God, because the explanation that the universe is so fit for life because God made it that way, you know, just to be anathema to scientists and technologists. But I have to say that I know religious scientists who are very comfortable with the idea of the multiverse and God. I mean, they say supernatural. I've tried to do is to get away from using this word God, because it means so many different things to so many people. And what I think is more helpful to focus on is not is there a God who explains the universe, but does the universe have a meaning or a purpose? I used to use that word design, and I'm very scared of doing it these things. But I would certainly say that the universe appears as if it's got a meaning or a purpose. A better word I have is that the universe seems to be about something. You can't be a scientist unless you suppose that there is a coherent scheme of things. And when we do our science, when we get to the next level, and reality is what uncover what's coming next, we expect a time, order, and rationality. We don't expect it all to fall apart if we go to the next level. So science is predicated on this act of faith. It is a coherent scheme of things, and the universe isn't just some sort of arbitrary hodgepodge of odds and ends. It's hanging together, so it's about something. I'm not sure that's quite the same as purpose, but it seems to be close to the notion of meaning. So we find meaning in the universe. Science is, after all, an exercise in uncovering what's going on. And it's got to be meaningful, otherwise you wouldn't be a scientist.
So there we use the term regularities. Look for regularities in nature.
Regularities is one of them, but I think it doesn't capture the coherent whole. It's not make sense, you see. It's not just, well, okay, we can just plot a graph and it's got a shape, and that's the end of it.
Well, why does it not make sense?
It does not make sense. And most physicists, even the most strongly atheistic physicists, expect it to make sense of them. As an act of faith, they believe that it's intelligent. And beautiful, furthermore, that it's not just, oh yes, that's what this has such a mass and that force strength and such. They expect to have an underlying theory where it's that wonderful sense of, now I see how it all falls into place. And I bet you, if you ask even the most atheistic scientists, they would admit, well, yes, we do expect that that's what we find. Now, they won't say, well, that's what we found up to now, but probably if we could look further, all that will fall apart and it won't be a coherent scheme of things. So I like to say, not so much, well, there is a purpose for God who has sort of made the world, and the purpose of the universe can be seen through that theological dimension. It's more that the purposefulness or meaningfulness of the universe is inherently meaningless, and we discern that through science. So many people think that science and mathematics are the enemy of meaning and purpose of the universe. They think that science demystifies the universe and therefore robs it of any sort of meaningful content. But I say it's just the other way around. The more we use science, the more we learn about the wonders of the universe we're in, the more convinced I am that it's about science, that there is a scheme.
So there we have Paul Davies wanting meaning, wanting purpose, and scratching for it, but without a mind. So he wants some sort of impersonal meaning behind the universe. Somehow it's just inherent in the physical laws that govern the universe. And that's the stance of quite a lot of those who are cosmologists or physicists who have no theistic understanding or belief. So Paul Davies would declare himself an agnostic, not an atheist, but he tries to dodge what seems to be the common sense inference that when you have meaning or purpose, which he so desperately wants, that there must be a mind. You might recall last time we started with Thomas Aquinas. I thought I'd just return there briefly. The reason I thought I'd return there is because we just love the flow of his language, don't we? So straightforward. So here's his fifth way, which is his teleological argument. The fifth way is taken from the governance of the world. We see that things which lack intelligence, such as natural bodies, act for an end. And this is evidenced from their acting always, or nearly always, in the same way, so as to obtain the best result. Hence, it is plain that not fortuitously, but designedly, do they achieve their end. Now, whatever lacks intelligence cannot move towards an end unless it be directed by some being endowed with knowledge and intelligence, as the arrow is shot to its mark by the archer. Therefore, some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to their end, and this being we call God. A view rather different from that just espoused by Paul Davies. So the teleological argument, what's it actually mean? Well, it arises primarily from the commonsensical observation that the world and its many parts appear to be designed to achieve a purpose. And the word teleological itself is derived from two Greek words, telos, which just means end or goal, purpose, and logos, meaning reason or explanation. So teleological means you start from the end or the purpose and you reason backwards, explaining things based on their end purpose. If you want to be a bit of a philosopher and express it in what's called standard form, we'll put it this way. Four premises and a conclusion. Human artefacts are products of intelligent design. They have a purpose. The universe resembles these human artefacts. Therefore, it is probable that the universe is a product of intelligent design and has a purpose. However, the universe is vastly more complex and gigantic than is a human artefact. Therefore, there is probably a powerful and vastly intelligent designer who created the universe. Or, as J.P. Morland put it, certain facts about the world cannot be adequately explained by impersonal causes, conditions, and laws of nature. But they can be adequately explained by a personal explanation. There is no reason to treat these facts about the world as unexplainable brute facts. It is better to use a form of explanation, personal explanation, to explain them. Moreover, some of these facts have characteristics that clearly indicate and only come from intelligent agents. So, the intelligent action of a designing person is the best explanation for these facts. Now, apart from Thomas Aquinas, we move on to William Paley, whom you may be familiar with. You may have heard of him. He's the one who sort of probably first set up what was called or espoused what's called the watchmaker argument. And you can see when he was around 1743 to 1805. That's not a meme that he created. That was just one I found, which you might like. But he says this. Suppose I found a watch upon the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think that, for anything I knew, the watch might have always been there. Yet, why should not this answer serve for the watch as well as for a stone that happened to be lying on the ground? And for this reason, and for no other. Namely, that if the different parts have been differently shaped from what they are, if a different size from what they are, or placed in any other manner, or any order other than that in which they are placed, either no motion at all would have been carried on in the machine, or none which would have answered the use of it that is now served by it. Now, you can see where he's going with that. He says, here's the thing, it looks like it has a purpose. If anything was different about it, it wouldn't serve that purpose. And so that suggests that an intelligent person, a being, made it to fulfil a purpose. It's not like a rock, which happens to be lying around. His watchmaker argument, though, has often been misunderstood as an argument from simple analogy. Now, the argument from simple analogy is really just a cause and effect argument. So, for example, if you look at a house, you see the effect of the work of an architect or a builder. That's the cause. And thus, when you look at the world, you might, by way of analogy, see it as the effect of the work of a vastly more intelligent designer or architect. David Hume, Scottish philosopher and author of Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, challenged the argument from analogy by arguing that human artefacts and the world are too dissimilar to draw any strong conclusions about the causes. In addition, he says, we have first-hand observational experience of house building, but no experience of world building. So any inference regarding the possibility of an intelligent designer is little better than guesswork, he claims. Finally, even if there is a divine designer, there is little that can be said with any certainty about the designer himself. After all, if you use the analogy of a house, should you not use it to its fullest extent? For instance, how many people are involved in building a house? So surely if you take an analogy from house building, you could argue for polytheism. So Paley was well aware of Hume's critique of that argument from simple analogy. So his watchmaker argument is actually framed in such a way as to not be subject to the same criticism. So he says this. Every indicator of contrivance, every manifestation of design which existed in the watch, exists in the works of nature. with the difference on the side of nature of being greater and more, and that in a degree which exceeds all computation. I mean that the contrivances of nature surpass the contrivances of art. By art he doesn't mean painting, he means by like construction, design. In the complexity, subtlety and curiosity of the mechanism. And still more, if possible, do they go beyond them in number and variety. Yet in a multitude of cases are not less evidently mechanical, not less evidently contrivances, not less evidently accommodated to their end or suited to their office than are the most perfect productions of human ingenuity. So Paley's argument doesn't rely on analogy alone. It takes things a step further and draws on function and purpose. A designer has a purpose, and a watch is designed and manufactured to serve that purpose. Thus, the emphasis of the argument is on the purpose of the artefact, the purpose the artefact serves, and the functional complexity required of that object to serve that purpose. These features are reliable indicators of design. The works of nature also possess functional complexity, which allows for one to justifiably conclude that the works of nature were created by an intelligent agent. Quoting from a philosophy text, what matters for Paley's argument is that works of nature and human artefacts have a particular property that reliably indicates design. Regardless of how dissimilar any particular natural object might otherwise be from a watch, both objects exhibit the sort of functional complexity that warrants an inference that it was made by an intelligent designer. So you can see that his argument is based on not just a simple analogy, but on the notion of functional complexity. Let's move on. Now, to counter, because there's always counters, you see, with these things, just to be annoying, to counter the design inference inherent in Paley's watchmaker example, supporters of Darwinian evolution argue that functional complexity in living organisms can be explained by the addition of new traits that result from mutations, some of which will prove advantageous. And I'm quoting here, if the trait is sufficiently favourable, only members of the species with the trait will survive. By this natural process, functionally complex organisms gradually evolve over millions of years from primordially simple organisms. Now, Richard Dawkins, the well-known atheist, offers an analogy or an illustration from computer programming to demonstrate that natural selection offers a better explanation for origin and development of functional complexity by using the sentence, "Methinks it is a weasel." He found, by his programming a particular computer program, he found that when a computer was programmed to randomly generate this sequence of letters and spaces, methinks it is a weasel, each time starting over afresh. So each time it had to generate a new combination, he found that if that was the case, it would actually take an amount of time equivalent to about 2.5 times the length of time the universe has existed, according to Darwinian evolutionists, to produce the sentence correctly. In other words, it would be impossible. However, he says, if a cumulative step selection mechanism was employed in which the program randomly generated the sentence of letters and spaces, but rather than completely starting over each time, it retained in place all the correctly selected characters, the whole process only took half an hour and finally got the correct result. Now, the problem I have with this thought experiment is simply this, that its success is dependent upon the end result being predetermined and being used to determine the selection process. You've got to actually know you're aiming for "methinks it is a weasel" in order to know which letters to keep and which space to keep it where. So it strikes me that you actually have to know the end before you can actually engage in the process. But I assume Richard Dawkins is far cleverer than I am, and that seemed pretty obvious, but not to him, apparently. So it seems then that if that's the case, that's inconsistent with evolutionary theory, which is based on randomness and chance, with no end result or final purpose being assumed. So where does that leave us? What's the state of play? According to Richard Dawkins, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we would expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pointless indifference. Or from Joseph Ratzinger, the former Pope, who said, "Let us go directly to the question of evolution and its mechanisms. Microbiology and biochemistry have brought revolutionary insights here. We must have the audacity to say that the great projects of the living creation are not the products of chance and error. They point to a creating reason and show us a creating intelligence, and they do so more luminously and radiantly today than ever before. Which leads us into what we'll call the design inference. And the design inference has a number of components that we just need to be a little bit aware of. So if you're going to infer design, then you need to have a few properties. And one of those is first, contingency. That is, something is that didn't have to be, right? Which means it's dependent on something else. Complexity. The thing that happened is unlikely to reproduce by chance. Specification. The thing that happened conforms to some independently given pattern. And if these three criteria are met, it's reasonable to infer that the event was the purposive act of an intelligent agent. So, example. Let's say you have some paper. Let's have two sheets of paper. On one of them, you have spilled some ink. And on the other, someone has written a message. Now, when we see these bits of paper, even though we haven't witnessed the event that led to the ink on the paper in either case, we recognise that the message is the result of a purposive act of an intelligent agent. Now, given it could be that someone's picked up the bottle and gone, that's possible, but the writing of a message, that's not possible without a purposive agent. Our judgment has little to do with either the paper or the ink. Rather, it's the result of the fact that the message conforms to an independently given pattern. A pattern that involves semiotics, you know, signs, semantics, so meanings, syntax, order of words, and that kind of stuff. The message, rather than the accidental ink blot, satisfies the three criteria mentioned above. Actualising one among several competing possibilities, ruling out the rest, specifying the one that was actualised, encapsulates how we recognise intelligent agency, or equivalently, how we recognise design. Now look at some of the just follow on from that to look at some of the modern teleological arguments. We often think of this in terms of intelligent design and the intelligent design movement and the arguments associated with that. Darwin made this interesting observation of his own work. He said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Which is why we actually don't have Darwinism anymore. Well, it's why we have neo-Darwinism, because the theory has broken down. So let's have a little look. One of the major proponents of one of these modern teleological arguments is Michael Behe, who's a biochemist, and his argument is based on something called irreducible complexity. Now, design theorists often talk about a couple of different kinds of complexity. There's cumulative complexity and there's irreducible complexity. So something that is cumulatively complex can lose parts or components without really a complete loss of function. So, for example, a city is cumulatively complex. It has buildings and roads and you name it. If you take away a building, the city still functions. If you take away a road, the city still functions. You know, you can take away bits, it's complex, but it still functions. But something that is irreducibly complex will lose function if a part is lost. For example, a mouse trap. You know, you take away the spring or you take away the base. Whatever, you take away any one part, it ceases to work as a mouse trap. So as a mouse trap, it is irreducibly complex. It can't be made any more simple than it is. Take away one part, the whole thing ceases to work. So Michael Behe, along with some others, has identified a number of biochemical systems that are, in his thinking, irreducibly complex. In other words, they have to be as they are in order to exist. They can't be precursor versions of them. Now, if this is so, such systems must begin to exist as complex wholes, and that's contrary to Darwin's contention that biological systems begin simply and become more complex as a consequence of evolutionary processes. So Michael Behe says, an irreducibly complex system cannot be produced by slight successive modifications of a precursor system, that is, a system that's come before it. Because any precursor to an irreducibly complex system that is missing a part is, by definition, non-functional. Since natural selection can only choose systems that are already working, if a biological system cannot be produced gradually, it would have to arise as an integrated unit in one fell swoop for natural selection to have anything to act on. So I'll show you a video, and this is a video of a thing called a bacterial flagellum. Some of you might be familiar with this already, but let's have a look.
In Darwin's Black Box in 1996, Behe spotlighted and made famous a number of really interesting discoveries that have been occurring in biochemistry and cell biology over the last two or three decades. And what biologists, molecular biologists, cell biologists, microbiologists have been discovering is that at the level of individual cells, there are little tiny examples of nanotechnology, little tiny machines at work. The flagellum motor is the one that Behe made most famous. It's a rotary engine that powers a whip-like tail, a protein tail, that functions like a propeller. And it moves the bacteria through liquid, enabling the bacteria to essentially track down its food supply. And this little machine includes a rotor, a stator, a drive shaft, a U-joint, bushings, bearings, and a whip-like tail that functions like a propeller. And the machine in some bacterial systems turns at 100,000 RPMs in one direction and can reverse direction on a quarter of a turn and turn 100,000 RPM in the other direction.
Bacterial flagellum is a true nano machine, about 40 nanometers in size. It's amazing. I mean, E. coli, Salmonella, which are kind of our model systems for the bacterial flagellum, can propel a cell about 20 lengths per second through a very viscous medium, like water in these organisms. And you extrapolate that to human scale. 20 body lengths per second, 6 foot person, you know, times 20, 120 feet per second. Mark Spitz or Phelps would be setting records with this type of propulsion.
It's hardwired into a signal transduction circuit. It allows the bacterium to sense changes in the sugar gradient in the surrounding liquid.
This signal transduction system is actually a short-term memory system where the cell is, if it's going in the direction of an attractant, a nutrient that it can use to metabolize, it follows that chemical gradient. And if it's a repellent, it will sense that and move in the opposite direction. So it's more than just this engine.
It's an extraordinary piece of nanotechnology. It's high-tech in low life. And so just by spotlighting these extraordinary pieces of nanotechnology inside cells, and the flagellum motor was the only one by any means, Behe, in a sense, opened up a window for people. He opened up the black box of the inner workings of the cell and said, look, this is much more complex than anything that the early evolutionary biologists had envisioned. Darwin knew nothing of this type of nanotechnology in cells, and at the very least, we've got to come up with an explanation for this.
Okay. I'll leave that there if you want to check that later. There are critics, of course, of these kinds of arguments, and so the critics of the argument from irreducible complexity argue that it's not necessary that a precursor system be functional so long as the organism of which it is a part is able to survive. In other words, you don't have to have that whole thing already going if you have something that's a bit similar, as long as it's inside something else that is alive. Right, so that's what they argue. In other words, the precursor system is able to become more complex over time just because it's inside or part of something else that's actually functioning. So it doesn't need to be fully functional from the very beginning, so the critics say. Thus, the design explanation for irreducible complexity probably can't really be considered an absolute clincher. However, it remains a particularly reasonable, if not probable, explanation. It forms part of this cumulative case in support of the teleological argument, in which it may be reasonably contended that the apparent design of the universe is best accounted for by the existence of a designer rather than the random mutations of natural selection. A second teleological argument that's used currently comes from biological information. One of the main proponents is Stephen Meyer, who is actually the chap who you saw on the screen just then. And he says this. He looks at information theory. He says information sequences have four characteristics. They are, first, complex, not simple. For example, AB, repeated over and over and over again, is simple, but Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet is complex. It cannot or could not be generated by chance. So you can't just have a bunch of monkeys typing and suddenly turn up with Romeo and Juliet. Information sequences are specific. Specific symbols need to be selected in a specific order. They're not simply composed of iterative, that's a science word for repeating stuff, repetitive units such as AB, 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 AB. And also the whole is prior to their parts. That is, it's more important than the parts themselves. So if you remove, for example, AB from an AB, AB, AB sequence, all you would do was have a bit of a gap. It wouldn't do anything in terms of meaning. But if you remove a word from a sentence, it does make quite a bit of difference. So meaning and the various components that go to make meaning are rather significant, as you can tell from this. Although by the time she's grandma, she's probably a bit tough, so you may not wish to. Anyway. Here's the probably the obvious example from DNA. Deoxyribonucleic acid. The function of DNA is to store all the genetic information that an organism needs to develop, function and reproduce. And apparently if you uncoil the DNA contained in the cells of the human body and join them together, because they're very tightly woven little coils, they would, actually a missing word there, but they would reach to the sun and back 70 times, and that's just in our body. Each strand of DNA contains 3 billion base pairs. Now, base pairs, you can see where those the coloured little bits that slot together are shown on the diagram. Each one of those is a base pair. So each strand of DNA contains 3 billion base pairs, which is equivalent to roughly 1.5 gigabytes of information. There are 40 trillion cells in the human body, something there are many more, but at least 40 trillion cells in the human body, which translates apparently to 60 zettabytes of information. Until I started reading this, I'd never heard of zettabyte before. I'm not a mathematician. But apparently that's 60 followed by 21 zeros, which I think is a really big number. Now, the argument from biological information is grounded in the fact that things like DNA contain information. As Stephen Meyer puts it, just as the letters in the alphabet of a written language may convey a particular message depending on their sequence, so too do the sequences of nucleotides or bases in the DNA molecule convey precise biochemical instructions that direct protein synthesis within the cell. So they're the things that actually drive our lives and our growth and our reproduction. How do we explain the existence of this biological information? Could it occur by purely random processes? Or is it reasonable to infer that, like all other information, it has an intelligent cause? Assuming ideal circumstances at the beginning of time, the probability of obtaining functioning amino acids, that is the building blocks of proteins, through purely random processes is estimated as 1 in 10 to the 65. Okay? Given that conditions were a lot likely to be ideal, and I'm speaking as the evolutionists would speak, given that conditions were not likely to be ideal, the figure may well be as great as 1 in 10 to the 125. Meyer says again, given the complexity of proteins, it is extremely unlikely that a random search through all the possible amino acid sequences could generate even a single relatively short functional protein in the time available since the beginning of the universe, let alone the time available on Earth. From this, it's reasonable to infer that the cause of biological information is an intelligent agent.
Probably.
that information is like. It's not just complex information, it's specific information.
Let me get just a little bit of a science lesson here. There are two definitions of information that engineers and scientists and ordinary people are familiar with. In the engineering world, there's something called Shannon information, or it's a mathematical formula that describes how much information can be carried along an information channel. So it's something called information carrying capacity. And the mathematical definition of information only captures a part of what we typically mean by information. It just refers to the improbability of a sequence of characters. The more improbable an arrangement of characters, the more information is being conveyed.
It's like an alphabet where you just have gibberish. You got a lot of letters, but it doesn't do anything.
So look at, for example, on this slide, we have at the top, I, U, I, N, S, K. The gibberish string is an information carrying channel. It could be arranged to convey information, but we don't know whether it's functional or non-functional. We don't know whether it's giving, it can convey any meaning. But we can still calculate how improbable that exact string is. And that's all the mathematical theory of information does. It calculates the information carrying capacity, but it doesn't tell us whether the information is functional or specifically arranged to convey a function.
DNA has the second.
It has the second type of information. And here I use an English analogy with tied and primary for no man. A clearly functional string of characters that is conveying information that is meaningful. Okay. Now, there's some terminology that goes with this. The top string is said to be complex, but it's not said to be specified and complex. In mathematical problems, complexity and improbability are the same idea. So the more improbable, the more complex something is. But DNA isn't just complex. It's not just an improbable arrangement of characters. It's specified and complex. Just like English language or computer code is specified and complex. So when we talk about the DNA enigma, the mystery surrounding the origin of the information you need to build the first cell, we're not just talking about information in the mathematical sense of improbability, like the first line in the slide to my right. Instead, we're talking about information that is specified. The arrangement of characters matters to the function the string of characters performs. And that's what we have in DNA. And Francis Crick made that point very early on when he said he was aware of the mathematical theory of information. He said, well, we're talking about information in DNA. We're not talking about merely mathematical information, merely Shannon information, as it's called by engineers. We're talking about specified information or functional information. And here it says, information means here the precise determination of the sequence, either of the bases in the DNA or the amino acids in the proteins. Those subunits of those important molecules have to be specifically arranged to perform the jobs that they do inside cells.
This has been an ATRI production.
There you go. It's good to know that. Now, as we've said of other things, there are counter-arguments to the argument from biological information. Firstly, there are those who simply reject any argument that requires inference. The reason is they argue that we can only infer a cause of an effect if we have some prior experience that warrants such an inference. Thus, we have experiential knowledge of human agents making things from pre-existing materials, which means that the design inference is in keeping with actual experience of the ways things are in the world which we inhabit. Whereas to infer an intelligent agent as the cause of a biological system presupposes a prior acceptance or belief in that agent or God, or the possibility of a God. Secondly, once the possibility of there being a God is discounted, or at least given no privileged status, other possibilities remain viable. Most of those who support neo-Darwinian evolutionary explanations of the world and the way it is simply argue that necessity or chemical necessity plus chance plus time provides a sufficient explanation for biological information. The big problem for such an explanation is that even those who support such a viewpoint acknowledge that the amount of time needed to bring into existence the kinds of sophisticated functional biological systems that exist on the Earth, such as those that go up to make up the workings of the human body and its cells, is so great that the Earth itself has not been around long enough for them to have happened by chance. And the third argument, the last one for tonight, and there are some others, but this will do, is an argument from fine tuning. And that's where we started this evening with Paul Davies. He was talking about the apparent fine tuning of the universe, sometimes called the Goldilocks principle, the idea that the universe is just right for life, that everything about it seems to be just right. And in fact, it is just right. Part of it is about how do we get to the just rightness of it. Some call it the anthropic principle. It's just right for human life. The laws of science, says Stephen Hawking, as we know them at present, contain many fundamental numbers, like the size of the electric charge of the electron, the ratio of the masses of the proton and the electron. The remarkable fact is that the values of those numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. And as Ethan Siegel, a PhD in astrophysics, says, if you give me the laws of physics and these 26 constants, so there are 26 constants, that is physical or mathematical formulas that go to make up the mathematics behind the universe, I can throw these into a computer and tell it to simulate my universe. And quite remarkably, what I get out looks pretty much indistinguishable from the universe we have today, from the smallest subatomic scales all the way up to the largest cosmic ones. So let's just play another video to give a simple explanation of all of that.
From galaxies and stars, down to atoms and subatomic particles, the very structure of our universe is determined by these numbers. These are the fundamental constants and quantities of the universe. Scientists have come to the shocking realization that each of these numbers has been carefully dialed to an astonishingly precise value, a value that falls within an exceedingly narrow, life-permitting range. If any one of these numbers were altered by even a hair's breadth, no physical, interactive life of any kind could exist anywhere. There'd be no stars, no life, no planets, no chemistry. Consider gravity, for example. The force of gravity is determined by the gravitational constant. If this constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th parts, none of us would exist. To understand how exceedingly narrow this life-permitting range is, imagine a dial divided into 10 to the 60th increments. To get a handle on how many tiny points of a dial this is, compare it to the number of cells in your body, or the number of seconds that have ticked by since time began. If the gravitational constant had been out of tune by just one of these infinitesimally small increments, the universe would either have expanded and thinned out so rapidly that no stars would form and life wouldn't exist, or it would have collapsed back on itself with the same result. No stars, no planets, and no life. Or consider the expansion rate of the universe. This is driven by the cosmological constant, a change in its value by a mere one part in 10 to the 120th parts would cause the universe to expand too rapidly or too slowly. In either case, the universe would again be life prohibiting. Or another example of fine tuning. If the mass and energy of the early universe were not evenly distributed to an incomprehensible precision of one part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd, the universe would be hostile to life of any kind. The fact is, our universe permits physical, interactive life only because these, and many other numbers, have been independently and exquisitely balanced on a razor's edge. Wherever physicists look, they see examples of fine-tuning. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. If anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features that the universe has, he's hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely. What is the best explanation for this astounding phenomenon? There are three live options. The fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. Which of these options is the most plausible? According to this alternative, the universe must be life-permitting. The precise values of these constants and quantities could not be otherwise. But is this plausible? Is a life prohibiting universe impossible? Far from it. It's not only possible, it's far more likely than a life prohibiting universe. The constants and quantities are not determined by the laws of nature. There's no reason or evidence to suggest that fine-tuning is necessary. How about chance? Did we just get really, 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 really lucky? No. The probabilities involved are so ridiculously remote as to put the fine-tuning well beyond reach of chance. So, in an effort to keep this option alive, some have gone beyond empirical science and opted for a more speculative approach, known as the multiverse. They imagine a universe generator that cranks out such a vast number of universes that, odds are, life-permitting universes will eventually pop out. However, there's no scientific evidence for the existence of this multiverse. It cannot be detected, observed, measured, or proved. And the universe generator itself would require an enormous amount of fine-tuning. Furthermore, small patches of order are far more probable than big ones. So the most probable observable universe would be a small one inhabited by a single, simple observer. But what we actually observe is the very thing that we should least expect: a vast, spectacularly complex, highly ordered universe inhabited by billions of other observers. So even if the multiverse existed, which is a moot point, it wouldn't do anything to explain and fine-tune. Given the implausibility of physical necessity or chance, the best explanation for why the universe is fine-tuned for life may very well be it was designed that way. A common sense interpretation of facts suggests that a super intellect monkeyed with physics, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. There is for me powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge.
So that then brings us to where we started with the fine-tuning argument with Paul Davies. Acknowledging the possibility of design and seeking meaning. Now, I'm not suggesting that any one of these arguments is a clincher for the existence of God, or God as the cause, or there even being a designer. But if we're looking at a cumulative case, and we've got things like irreducible complexity, biological information, and the fine-tuning of the universe, and we put those together, we need to ask ourselves the question, what's the best explanation? What's the inference to the best explanation? And although there are arguments against, it seems to me when you put all of these things together that the argument or the explanation that fits best is the existence of an intelligent designer. None of these arguments tell us who that designer is, nor are they intended to. That's a different kind of argument altogether. But we seem to at least be able to point in the direction of the existence of a designer behind it all. Irreducibly complex biological systems, the information contained in molecules such as DNA, and the fine tuning of the universe that allows human life to even exist. So there we come to the end of our discussion, or my discussion, of teleological arguments. I hope that's been in some way helpful, and I believe the recording may have actually worked this time. So, we have about 9 minutes if anyone would like to make a brief observation, not a long observation, or ask a question. I can't guarantee that I can answer the question. You may have guessed as I was speaking that much of the stuff to do with mathematics and physics I learned in the last few weeks. Peter's there with the microphone if anyone has anything they'd like to either say or ask. 10 seconds left. 10. 9. 8. 7. 6. 5. 4. 3. 2. 1. Okay, let's pray. Father, we do thank you for the wonders of the universe within which we live, the universe that you have given us to inhabit and this planet Earth that you have granted us to occupy and to live in. Father, we thank you for the wonders of the human frame that you have made, for the complexity of the cells, of its functioning. And we thank you, Lord, that you have given us a direction, a sense of purpose, an awareness that there is, in fact, meaning in all of this. Father, we do just pray that you might, use even this kind of information to open conversations, to allow us to perhaps speak with others with some measure of confidence as we declare that you are the cause of this universe. You are the designer behind all that is. So, Father, we do just give you thanks again for being able to come together tonight. And we thank you that you are with us always and that you are the one who is the object of our worship. You are the one who imbues all things with meaning.